Greetings, everyone. It is now time for Marked Safe, tales of your very favorite and most beloved man-made disasters. On Marked Safe, we discuss events and details that some may find disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. Please listen responsibly. And now, here with your hosts, Brianne and Melanie, this is Marked Safe.
Good evening, Brianne.
Good evening, Melanie.
How are you doing?
I am splendid. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm really, really excited about this episode.
I don't know anything about this episode.
I didn't.
I kind of like it when it's a total secret.
Me too. You said your next episode's going to, if it's what you think it is going to be a total secret.
My next episode is top secret.
I'm really excited about this.
Top secret. I will not even give you a clue. I won't even give you a century. If you need to know if it is conflicting with whatever your next one ends up being, you can tell me the year of yours, because I'm not telling you anything about mine.
My next episode, because I've already started researching that one, is actually a fairly new one. It's a, it's new-ish.
I love new ones.
Like late 90s, early aughts.
I'm not telling you when mine is, so.
But mine's about poop, so.
Poop? Okay. Yeah, that sounds like your brand.
Okay.
Are you going to be mean to me? Before we started recording, you were just telling me that the pregnancy is making you mean this time.
Yes, I'm being super mean to everyone, which is weird because this is my fifth pregnancy. I've never been mean to people in any of my pregnancy, but I am tolerating zero bullshit.
Well, so far you haven't been mean to me, but I'm kind of hoping that you will be just like one time, just a little bit, because I can't even picture it. just give me a glimpse. Or you could just be mean to someone else and then send me some screenshots. That would be better.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Somebody pissed me off the other day. I don't remember who it was. I don't know. I've definitely been like hexing people with my sweet pickle, you know.
I beg your pardon?
You know, when I get really mad at someone, I hope
with
that
your sweet. Oh, yes.
Yes, the bread and butters.
Yes.
Like,
tell people your hex.
So if somebody really upsets me, I curse them to forever for the rest of their life. When they really want baby dills, they accidentally get bread and butter pickles instead.
I don't eat pickles, so I'm just going to have to assume that's a sick burn. Everybody else seems to feel like it is.
I'm doing that total, like, cliche I crave pickle thing right now, too, which is not really my brand at all. But spicy pickles. Which I didn't.
Spicy pickles.
I didn't know spicy pickles were a thing.
I didn't either, and I didn't want to.
Oh, they're so freaking good. I found it's like a spicy maple pickle I found at Walmart the other day. I think it's like
what?
Sam's Club brand.
Oh, those flavors don't go together at all.
They do. They are so delicious.
I'm upset with you, Melanie.
Oh, it's like this. Pretty much all I can eat. I just keep barfing up everything. And
this baby is going to be weird.
This baby is going to be weird. Hopefully. Oh, yeah. I'm way further along than I thought I was. I know last week I said I was 8 weeks, but I had my ultrasound. I'm 12 weeks. So
man, wait a little bit longer. You would have been on. I didn't know I was pregnant.
Yeah. So we had the genetic testing and we'll just see what this thing is.
Maybe it's a cryptid.
That would be so cool. Can you imagine little baby Sasquatch in my belly?
I'll be careful not to send my jinxers at your uterus with that.
Well, they say that like if you have heartburn, like your baby is supposed to be like hairy.
I mean, it was true for me. My baby was a freaking werewolf.
So I'm wondering, because my heartburn has been out of control. It's possible. Yeah. A big Bigfoot could be in my belly.
Well, yeah. I'd never really taken the heartburn old wives tale to that extreme, but you have a point. It was kind of true for Adelaide. She had an incredibly crazy head full of hair, but also like she had hair in her ears that like made a little point, so she looked like a werewolf, like a really hairy back. She's still
oh my gosh pretty, Arya was like hairy. That too. Ava really? Was bald as bald can be, like ugh. She was 2 years old, like not a stitch of hair on her body, and she's like baby Huey. Everybody was just like you know, she just looked like this giant baby because she was just bald, but she wasn't. She was so weird. So well, now we got this happy shit out of the way. You want to hear a disaster?
I would love to hear a disaster. Tell me something terrible.
Oh, this one's so terrible, but it's not too terrible. This is, you know what? I really think this is probably my favorite episode I've ever researched. I really? Yeah, I went down a couple fun rabbit holes. Well, I don't know if fun's the right word, but interesting. It's just interesting, and I've never heard about this before. So
fun to disaster podcasters, at least.
Right. It's terrible. And
hopefully fun to listeners.
Yeah, it's definitely terrible, but it's really super interesting, and I never heard it. So
all right, lay it on me.
You said you weren't gonna be accountable for this, but because you didn't remember, so it doesn't count. But you did a couple episodes ago say that maybe I could cover a Christmas party disaster.
Okay.
So that's what I'm doing.
Okay. I don't remember saying it, but I do believe you.
Okay. Well, so I typed in Christmas party disaster. I thought, surely something's going to pop up. You know what popped up? Like all these stupid articles. Like, I was so mortified. Like,
oh, yeah, no. No, we're not looking for that kind.
No. And
not the cringy kind.
Yeah. I mean, I want like a real good disaster, not you're like, I'm so embarrassed, like, you know, I scanned my boobs on the copier, not that stuff. And it's like, and you know what, like you read them and they're not sourced, there's no names to it, so
of course
you can't believe them because they just feel made up.
Yes.
I don't know, like I guess that's like what you'd call clickbait.
And tonight you'll be doing a clickbait compilation.
No.
No? Okay.
I fucking love clickbait, though. Like, if anyone wants to know who the target audience for clickbait is, it's me. I'm the target audience. Like, I need to know if, let's see, Amelia Earhart, was she eaten by giant coconut crabs?
Like, she was.
No, she wasn't. She wasn't. I
really appreciate the people who will go in the comment sections and just summarize it.
Oh, but and everyone's like, you're the hero we needed, or whatever that little thing is. No, I don't like that. I won't read the comments because it's like, I don't know, it's like a scavenger hunt. Like, I have to get through all these ads, and it's just going to feel
an odd duck.
So fulfilling to finally get to the end. I also really, really, really love those. They pop up on Facebook, and it's like, they're usually like fan fictions or stories or fantasies.
Oh, those are so weird.
And they like, you kind of read them and get sucked in. You're like, what the fuck? I want the rest of the story.
And it's always like some weird werewolf shit.
Oh, I love it. I love that stuff so much. So.
Oh, God.
But the Christmas party stuff, the embarrassing stuff, like, if anybody actually has one that we can put your name to, send us those too. Like,
absolutely.
I want a real life Christmas party embarrassing story. Balance
just
this out.
Just want some gossip.
Gossip.
Some gossip.
So, obviously, quick content warning. This too has death and injury almost exclusively to children. So, sorry.
All right.
When I first saw this story, I legit thought it was a Christmas party for adults. It just happened to be like a just brief article I read, and so I was like, oh, this is perfect. But when I really started like digging into it, I'm like, oh no, this was not a Christmas party for adults at all.
Oh dear. So, okay.
All right. So today I'm going to cover the 1913 massacre It's also known as the Italian Hall disaster. It just kind of depends on which side of the aisle you fall on this one. So, this story begins in a place called Red Jacket, Michigan. So if you're familiar with Michigan and you're sitting there thinking, what the fuck is she talking about? Red Jacket, it doesn't exist anymore. It's Calumet. And it's a home to about 700 folks due to its consistently shrinking population. But we'll kind of get to that a little bit later. There's a couple really great PBS docs on the I love PBS. Thank you, PBS.
Oh, I do too.
They have two documentaries. One's called The 1913 Massacre and the other one's called Red Metal. Very, very good. Yeah. Red Metal, I think you can actually watch that on Prime right now.
Oh my God, what a spooky name.
Right? So in the 1913 Massacre, there's this really cute part where the locals, they like try to explain where Calumet is. And the way they explain it is kind of like upper and lower Michigan with their hands in terms of mittens.
Oh, yeah. My family's from Michigan. I'm very familiar with the mitten thing.
You're familiar?
Oh, incredibly. Yeah.
Well, I was going to make you do the mitten thing. I even wrote it down and made Cody practice it with me.
Oh, my God.
I'm not going to make you do the mitten thing now. But yeah, so since you're familiar with it, so if you do the Michigan hand mitten map thing, the thumb that's up top, that peninsula, that's where Calumet is, all the way up top there.
Okay. So is it in the Upper Peninsula?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, that's a spooky place.
Really?
I mean, I think it, I don't know.
It seems like it. I mean, because that's like copper
country. I consider it spooky. Yeah.
Oh, you know.
It's just, it seems like somewhere that anything could happen.
I totally get that vibe. I'm so glad you said that.
I've never actually been to the UP, but I've heard about a lot of spooky stuff and sometimes maybe paranormal stuff and just a lot of horrible murders and weird people living up there. And I don't know. I've always been kind of spooked out by the UP.
This is right up your alley then.
Okay. Is it supernatural?
No. It could be, though.
We need to do a disaster with, like, a supernatural element sometime.
I do talk about some supernatural stuff, though.
Oh, my God. Okay.
It's all speculative. But I'm so glad you said that. You're my best friend. I love you. Okay. So, Calumet, Upper Peninsula. So, yeah. And, like you said, the Google Michigan, or you can Google Michigan hand map. It's, like, completely a thing. And there's posters and they're really cute. And I think I'm going to buy them one. And I also realized when I was like looking at that I think I have a low key obsession with maps.
It seems like that. It comes up a lot for you.
Yeah. If this podcast goes sideways, I know it's totally niche, but I'm going to do a map podcast.
Wow. I would listen. You have one listener.
Oh, see? I love it. Okay. So in the late 1800s, copper mining exploded in Michigan, and Calumet was right at the forefront. Calumet and Hecla Mining Company was the largest mining company in Michigan. So much money was flowing out of these mines. I mean, it was bananas. So, just for scope, and because rabbit holes, one of the bigwigs and eventual owners of this mining company, Thomas Hotson Jr., he spared no expense when he built a 45-room mansion in 1908, 5 years before today's disaster story. This place is, I don't even know what to say. So
what does anyone need with 45 rooms?
Yeah, you know, he worked for the mining company. He was a bigwig. Like,
I guess.
So he spent $35,000 on furnishings alone. So with inflation, it's like just under $1 million. Can you imagine like spending that much money just furnishing your home?
I mean, I guess if it had 45 freaking rooms, maybe.
This place, it's like so over the top brand. It's like, I don't know. Okay. So because rich people, the dining room in this place, the wall coverings are made out of gilded and embossed elephant leather.
Oh, no.
The wallpaper is made from the skin of elephants.
Oh, the wallpaper?
Yeah, it's like the wall cover, like not like the drapes, the walls are covered.
I hate it.
In elephant skin.
Ew, that must have been a lot of elephants.
Mm-hmm. You know, because I was thinking like the time, like, is this a thing? So, of course, I was like, like, let's look it up. And not a lot popped up for like elephant hide wall coverings. I did see, allegedly, that Donald Trump was also a fan of doing this to his properties. So that kind of tells me everything I need to know.
Yuck. Did you find a picture of it?
No. It was just like an article about how, Donald Trump all of a sudden cares about elephants. Well, did he care when he was bragging to everybody about using elephants for his wall coverings? So I don't know.
Oh, my.
So I don't know. I mean, it's, I can't prove it, but it doesn't.
It tracks.
It tracks. This particular Copper Country Mansion, it's now actually a bed and breakfast. So after the pandemic, if you want to go check it out, totally can. Seems like they preserved a lot of it, including the walls, if you want to have some breakfast and look at some stuff. It's called Loria Manor Inn. I do wonder if it's haunted.
Haunted by elephants at the very least.
Right. But one of the rabbit holes I went down, I found out that for about 30 years, they turned it into a funeral home.
Ew.
Mm-hmm. And guess what?
What?
The undertaker that owned the house, he like murdered his wife and his grandson before like taking his life.
Oh my God.
So there you go. There's your spooky stuff.
Man, the content warnings on this one are going to be off the chain.
You better get to work.
I know.
I don't know. I found like an old newspaper article and it was like really creepy. I don't know. It was super creepy. Just, I'll post it. Just the way they explained it was bizarre and it was like, I don't know. I do think it's like kind of a strange thing to think about, like, if you worked at a funeral home, but then you're like on the other side of it, like,
yeah.
I mean, are your coworkers working on you? Like,
I mean, that happened in a show that we just recently talked about having watched.
Oh, yeah. Well,
yeah. Hill House.
Yeah, so strange. It's strange. Anyways, we'll get off this one. So
but I like it.
I know it's
there's
so
a
good.
Lot to unpack there.
Mm-hmm. So you have like these crazy mansions. They're popping up all over the place. People have so much money to spend from these copper mines. But here's the thing. The miners, the people that are doing the work, they're only making like 25 cents an hour. So obviously that too wasn't like... You didn't always get 25 cents an hour. It just kind of depended on your ethnicity, you know?
Yeah.
It did.
Seems sketch.
Totally sketch. Very racist, but that's how it shook out. So there's this huge divide going on here. There's like no middle ground. It's just like you're rich or you're poor. So you have all of these immigrants. They're coming into Ellis Island. And word on the streets is that the miners in Calumet they're only working 8 hours a day. And so for about $13 for the day, you know, for an hour, eight hours, $13 an hour, which, I mean, it's mine work. It's super dangerous. Like, it's still low for as dangerous as their job is, $13 an hour.
And what year is this?
This is 1913.
That seems like $1 million for 1913.
No, that's in today's money.
Oh, okay, never mind.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
Okay.
No, yeah. No, they weren't making that much. That's like, that's how much it would be in today's money. So $13 an hour. So they're coming into Ellis Island and they're like, oh, that actually sounds really good. You know, sounds fair.
Yeah.
For what it is. You know, they're coming in. They're starting their lives over. Well, the rumor was a goddamn lie. They were actually working well over 10 hours a day for less than half of that.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. So, but they've already traveled to Calumet.
Yeah,
you know?
They're there.
They're there. Like, what are you going to do? Like, you're tired. You're broke. You're fucking hungry. Like, you got to work. So, these miners are, you know, they're just doing the best they can. And they're spending their days, like, pretty much in complete darkness. And, you know, I never really considered it. And I know I did the Monaga mine disaster. And I've looked at a lot of mining photography. And for some reason, it just didn't translate in my head how dark it was. Because the photography at the time was all, like, flash powder and flash guns.
Yeah.
So it, like, lit up the whole...
Exposed it really well, yeah.
Right. It lit up the whole thing. But it was almost complete darkness in there. Like, it was... They only had, like, one or two little flame lamps. So... And the fact of them doing, like... Because that's basically a tiny explosion taking those pictures. Mm-hmm. Which, knowing how combustible shit is in mines, like, there has to be... I wouldn't let myself go down this rabbit hole, but there has to be some photography fatalities and injuries.
Yeah, there's got to be. Is this technically our third mining disaster one?
I think so.
I think so, yeah, because you did, I never know how to pronounce the one.
Monaga.
Yes. You did that one. Which one did I do? Oh, the one, Centralia was basically a mining disaster.
Yeah. This one technically is above ground, though.
Okay.
So, mining community, but all the disaster happens up top. It was super dark. They're doing the best I can. I can't even imagine what it's like to, like, wake up, it's dark, go to work, it's dark all day, get out of the mine, it's dark. It's got to be, like, miserable.
That would take a toll, yeah.
I wonder if there was, like, if, like, miners, you know, like, maybe suffer, like, some sort of, like, depression. What is that? Vitamin D, like vitamin D deficiency?
Yeah.
Or like seasonal depression?
Yeah. I always wonder how that is in Alaska. I mean, I could Google it. Like, I'm pretty sure it's been talked about a lot. But I wonder how they deal with that mental health wise.
Yeah. It's nuts. So 90% of Calumet's population, they're a foreign descent. One article I found said, quote, there were 8 daily foreign language newspapers, and old timers recall walking down crowded streets on a Saturday night and never hearing English.
Oh, wow.
So, really neat town. Calumet and Hecula owned everything in this town, not just the mines. Everything. Homes owned by Calumet and Hecula were leased to workers at a very generous $6 a month. So that's about $157 a month today for them to rent home. They had a school, library, hospital. They had bathhouses, you know, so they could relax and all that stuff. Because, you know, mining companies, they totally have the best interest of their workers in mind, right?
I mean, that's what they're known for.
Mm-hmm. No.
They're just like the Mr. Rogers of employers.
Yeah. Nope. So, Calumet and Hecla, they own that town. So, I mean, basically... You just don't fuck up, you know, because if you do, like you're basically losing your whole life. It's really sad. And also, like, don't lose your life because they're going to fucking kick you out. They're going to evict your family. Mm. That way they can, like, move in your replacement. Like,
Jesus Christ, that's dark.
Mm-hmm. There was a ton of stuff that killed miners, too, in Calumet. It was, like, falling rock, explosive. There was drilling accidents, falling down shafts. I mean, this is just, I mean, I saw a list. It's unbelievable. It's long.
You're just going to say shafts and then slide right on by that without anything? I don't recognize you, Melanie.
Well, me sliding down a shaft got me really pregnant.
Oh, damn. You went there.
I went there.
I did. You went there. Okay.
Did I lose my sense of humor?
I don't think so. No. Okay. Doesn't look like it.
All right. I'm worried. I hope this baby did not break me.
You're a little John Mellencamp Sasquatch. It's going to be beautiful.
It's beautiful.
I wish I had better Photoshop skills.
So, yeah. These guys, they can be killed by lots of stuff. But it's a risk they were willing to take. Well, they had to fuck. They had no choice, right? They had to take it. You want to hear something pretty gross?
Yeah.
So there's this like shady practice that the mine company did. I could not believe this. So in one of the PBS docs I watched, there's this man and he's describing how his grandfather, he got silicosis. And it's basically an occupational lung disease, and it's really common with miners. So it basically happens, you're breathing in dust that contains silica, and it builds up in your lungs and breathing passages. And it basically, like, it scars your lungs, and it's making it almost impossible to breathe. It's really hard to breathe. So this guy's grandfather, he developed silicosis working in the mines. Well, Calumet and Hecla put his ass in the sanitarium. Okay.
Oh.
Right next, like with the tuberculosis patients.
Ooh.
So obviously he quickly caught and died from tuberculosis because that shit is fucking so contagious. Like,
yeah,
it's so fast. And by doing this, they were off the hook for paying the wives for the death of their spouses because technically, the men died of tuberculosis and not a work-related death. Oh,
are you fucking kidding me?
No.
Deaths know no bounds.
That, when I heard that, my jaw dropped to the ground. I've always been fascinated with tuberculosis anyways. We have, we had a hospital in Louisville called Waverly Hills. It's super fucking creepy. But it was a tuberculosis hospital. They had like a death chute where basically like, because there were so many people dying, they would like, you know, put them on this conveyor belt out back so people coming in wouldn't see. It's creepy. Creepy, creepy. We used to sneak in there all the time. Yeah. So you have your run-of-the-mill mine company bullshit these guys are just dealing with in order to barely provide for their families. So this actually takes a shift. Like, they're just dealing with it. It takes a shift when a desire to increase production even more leads to the introduction of the one-man drill. Because the new water drill could be operated by just one man, miners were faced with a scary new reality. Half of the men were about to lose their jobs. And the men that were lucky enough to keep theirs, now they have to work alone, which they're already working in a super dangerous place. And now you're going to have them like flying solo.
Yeah, they need people for more than just running the drill.
To make sure, like, if you're hurt, somebody can go fucking get help. Like,
yeah, that's not good.
No. So
I guess by the time you're being covered in this podcast, it's not good.
No. In comes Cowboy Charles Moyer.
A literal cowboy or like a kind of cowboy vibe?
No, he was a cowboy for a little bit.
Okay.
So our guy Charles, he's had a couple run-ins with the law though. He served time for robbery of a department store, and he may or may not have had something to do with the bombing of the home and assassination of a former Idaho governor, Frank Stuenberg.
Oh my god.
Mm-hmm. So, but Charles, I don't know why I call him Charlie.
That's very, very familiar of you.
I feel like I've been doing all this research. We're friends. I feel like I know him. Charlie. So Charles, he actually for some time worked in mines himself. So he had these pretty big feelings on workers' rights. This eventually led him on the path to becoming the president of the Western Federation of Miners, a labor union.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. He was very passionate about this cause. And if you were handing out superlatives, Charles would probably get the most militant.
Oh, well, I mean, what a crown to wear.
Yep.
Okay.
It definitely was not the most attractive, the most militant for sure. So Charles hears what's going on in Calumet, and he wants to help mine workers organize, so he heads to Michigan. His mission statement is basically, we assert that the working class and it alone can and must achieve its own emancipation.
Okay.
So that's Charles. Another big player we have in this story is a man named James McNaughton. Okay. He's the general manager of Calumet and Hecla Mining Company. He's known on the streets as the King of Houghton County, the Czar of Copper Country, or just Big Jim.
Oh, my. Okay. Mm-hmm.
We have a Big Annie in this story later, and this guy is an absolute toad, so we will just refer to him as James or James McNaughton going on here on out. I'm not going to give this fucking guy a nickname.
Okay.
So
maybe we could call him Little Jim.
Okay, Little Jim. Because
I bet he would not have liked it.
No, not at all. Little Jim had little sympathy for miners, like none at all. He did not give a shit. He was all about business and getting the biggest bang for his buck, okay?
Okay.
So when it came to union, I mean, it's just, if he could give it a big eye roll, he was giving it a big eye roll. And you have so many ethnicities out here, like, how in the hell could anyone possibly organize all these different people with all these different language? They're super diverse. No one's going to organize them for a strike. That's impossible. Okay? But Charles, he wasn't fucking around. So with him, he brought in translators and pamphlets that were written in the various languages. Smart, right?
Nice. Yeah.
He's not going to let anything like that stop him. So by July 1913, 9,000 men, a majority of the workers, they decided to join the union and they demanded action.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I bet Little Jim's going to love that.
Oh, Little Jim. So on July 14th, Little Jim and other mine managers, they received a letter on the behalf of the WFM asking for better work conditions, hours, and pay for the miners. And just to reiterate that they were serious in their request, the letter also said, quote, failure to answer will be taken as proof that you are not willing to have the matter settled peacefully.
Oh, shit.
If that sounds threatening, trust me, that was the intent.
Okay.
So yeah. Little Jim, nor the rest of the managers, they didn't answer the letter. Little Jim was steadfast that if he responded, it would validate the union. And in his mind, the union did not exist. It would not exist ever.
I don't think that's how it works.
It's like those little kids that throw the blanket on them or if they like, you know, you're looking at them, but they feel like if they're not looking at you, you can't see them.
Yeah. Nice try, Little Jim.
Yeah. That's kind of like the vibe I get from him. So on July 23rd, 1913, 14,000 men in three counties laid down their tools and began their strike. Successfully and with no delay, zero production from the copper mines began on day one. Like, it just stopped. Just stopped it. It's really incredible when you think about it.
Yeah.
Little Jim wasn't budging, though, and he told newspapers, quote, grass will grow in the streets before CNH recognizes the union.
And this gives me the vibes of a certain soon-to-be not leader in our country.
You just wait. Like, all of everything this fucking guy does screams that.
Okay.
I also think this quote is super dumb because I've seen grass grow in streets. Like, he clearly has too much faith in America's infrastructure.
Right?
You idiot.
So, yeah, I mean, that could happen today.
I've seen it.
Yeah.
It just makes me mad. All right, so he's just going to ignore it. So I couldn't find anything confirming it. But everything I watched, everything I read and listened to, and trust me, it was a lot. You can look at the things. Hopefully you can fit all these sources in the show notes. I don't know if you're going to have to break them down, but if we can't, we'll put the rest of them on the website. I really get strong indication that the sheriff, James Cruz, he was definitely in the pockets of Calumet and Hecla Mining Company.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. He just oozes law enforcement corruption. and this is me being a total asshole, but his appearance, like, totally fits that old-timey, good old boy grossness.
I think I like Mean Melanie.
Can I just send you a picture real quick?
Yes.
Okay. Because this guy, tell me if... Okay, I sent it right now. Am I being an asshole, or does he just...
Ooh, oh, Jesus. Oh, God. Okay.
Doesn't
no.
he just look like grubby, like...
He looks like he walks down the street, like, twirling his pocket watch and spitting on people.
Yes. Ugh, I would hate this to be my sheriff. Ugh.
Yeah.
Ugh. He's gross. He grosses me out. So we have this... Okay, I'm not being an asshole. Good.
No.
So this turd sends a telegram to the governor on day 2 of the strike, pretty much saying that the strikers were, like, out of control. This is what he said.
That sounds familiar.
Mm-hmm. Quote, situation here has become desperate. Immediate action on your part is the only thing that will prevent greater destruction of property and loss of life.
Okay.
That was a bold-faced lie. Actually, it was a telegram. It was a bold type lie. So, the governor, I mean, it's a telegram. It's not the news. You're not seeing anything on TV. It's 1913. You know what the fuck's going on.
Right.
This, you have a sheriff sending you this thing, and it just sounds like you have to do something, right?
Yeah, I guess.
He didn't know that, like, this guy was exaggerating, lying his ass off. So what's the governor do? He immediately sent out the entire National Guard, 2,500 men.
Oh, that's a lot.
Yeah. Thanks, Sheriff Cruz. Oh, but wait, there's more. Why stop there? Sheriff Cruz received, air quote, permission.
Hold on. Does he have your last name?
It's not spelt the same way. His is with a C. Mine's with a K. No relation.
Okay.
Can I just tell you something real quick?
Sure.
So we've been talking a little bit about baby names. Mm-hmm. And Aria, we were driving yesterday. We went to go look at some Christmas lights. There's supposed to be a big Christmas light thing at the college. And we went in. It was like, there was no Christmas. There was like... one string of Christmas lights. It was like a total fucking joke, but they had like cops out and stuff, and it was the whole campus. Oh. And there was like one string of lights, and I'm like, my kids were just like boring. It was just but it was fun because we got to spend time with each other. But we're on our way back, and Aria goes, Mom, I finally figured out a name for a boy. And I was like, okay. I was like, let's have it. And she goes, it's the best name I've ever heard. His name's going to be Tom. Tom Cruise.
Oh, my God.
And I'm like, no, honey. It's not going to be Tom.
I mean, I feel like when you already have 4 kids, there has to be a voting process.
I'm not. Look, John Mellencamp, Tom Cruise.
I need that to be on the ballot, at least.
So, yeah. Terrible. It was it was just like I popped her balloon. It was just like, no, honey.
Oh,
I was like,
poor baby.
She came up with a really cute girl name, though, that I love.
What was it?
And it's like definitely in the running. Like, it's top on the list for me.
Do you not want to say?
I don't want to say yet.
Okay.
I'll tell you later. But I'm still like, I'm marinating on it. But potentially, if it's a girl, Aria might be naming the kid. Because I really love it.
So,
it's not the end of the world. All right. So, Sheriff Cruz, he gets permission to hire an outside company, which really kind of only benefits the mining company, not everybody. So, under the guise of security guards of sort, 52 detectives from Waddell Mahone Agency of New York were brought in. These guys are what was commonly known back then as strike breakers, which was legal. It was a real job. Their job description was basically to spy on and protect replacement workers by any means necessary. Most of the time, this meant them getting real physical, even if the situation didn't call for it.
Oh, no.
Oh, wait. There's even more.
Oh, great.
Sheriff Cruz also decided to deputize over 400 men, mostly mining company employees that held their loyalty to the company.
I'm sure this is going to turn out super chill.
Mm-hmm. This number would actually, in the coming months, jump to 1,700 people that he deputized.
Oh my God.
Just a bunch of gun-toting egomaniacs, now backed by the law. I mean, it's like, Oprah, you get a badge. You get a badge. Telling you.
Stand down and stand by.
Yep. The strike wasn't all rainbows and butterflies with the miners, though. The longer the strike dragged on, the more tensions rose. The strike was beginning to divide the community, and there was open conflict. So they're fighting amongst themselves, too. And, I mean, it's probably really fucking scary putting yourself and your family in this situation to begin with.
Oh, yeah.
Like, do you... It's still going on. Like, do you keep firm in your convictions? Do you fold so you can have food on the table? Like, you're not working. You're not making money. There really is so much at stake. So as rallies and parades commenced in the street, strikers physically tried to discourage others from going back to work. They couldn't let the strike fall apart because then it would just be all for naught. And they would use any means necessary to get their demands. One of those means... women.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Anti-unionists would be less likely to beat the shit out of women, so strikers weaponized them. Enter Big Annie.
Oh, I've been waiting for Big Annie to get involved.
Big Annie is adorable. I think I have a major girl crush on it, Big Annie. I really, I love her. So, Anna Globuchar Klemenk, she was the daughter of Man, I've had a good track record of not, like, stumbling on words, but here we go. She was the daughter of Slovenian immigrants, and she would receive her moniker for a towering height of 6'2".
Oh, my God.
She was tall. So she's beautiful.
Hold on. How tall are you?
I'm 5'2".
Okay. Oh, wow. You're little.
How tall are you?
I think you're tall. I thought you were tall.
No, I'm little. I'm 5'2".
I always, in my head, you're like 5'8".
Nope. I got these nice little stumpy old legs.
And you have a tall face.
My face is really long.
It seems like a tall person.
I have a tall person face?
Uh-huh.
I think that's a compliment. I like it. How tall are you?
5'5".
You're taller than me.
Yeah.
We've been friends for years.
I was not picturing this at all.
No, it's so cool. It's so cool. I can't wait to meet you.
I feel like those are the two things that just like change everything when you meet someone that you haven't met that you like have a very clear mental image of is how tall they really are and how they smell.
I stink right now.
Oh, why? Why?
I don't know. I bought this, like, new hand sanitizer. Well, it's not new. It's the same brand that I got before the pandemic. But I don't know if they ran out of this stuff. It just, it's vomit. Like, I got in my car today because I had to pick up a couple things because Cody has to leave town for business, which is a whole nother thing. But I was like, I'm not spending 3 days without coffee. Like,
no.
I can't really, you know, I'm pregnant, probably shouldn't be drinking
four
it,
and
but...
I have kids and no husband.
I'm not letting go of my one cup of coffee I have a day. It's not fucking happening. So I went to go get some coffee, but I had replaced my hand sanitizer yesterday, and I don't know if it's like... It made my car stink.
Ooh.
So when
like
I...
What?
Like, what
does it
feet.
Smell like?
Like,
ooh.
Smelly feet. And so because I use my hand sanitizer and I haven't showered, I just jumped right into this podcast. I smell like, my hands smell like feet.
Okay. Well, I'll keep in mind that you're short and stinky.
Short and stinky.
Okay.
So, Big Annie, usually wearing a gingham dress and carrying an American flag on a 10-foot pole,
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm. Huge flag. She led marches for the strikers' efforts. She founded and served as president of the Women's Auxiliary No. 15 of the Western Federation of Miners. Her fight for social justice seemed limitless, and she wasn't alone in her efforts. She had an incredible amount of women that would gladly follow her. So these women, they would shout, they would cuss, they would dip their brooms in the excrements of outhouses and smear them on the opponents of the strikers.
I feel like it doesn't really matter what else you've got going on. If you're a 6'2" woman carrying a 10-foot flag, like, just follow her.
Follow her.
See where you end up.
Yeah. So, like, they're like, but they're dipping their brooms.
Oh, my.
In outhouse shit.
I mean, yuck. I don't like that.
And smearing it.
Oof.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly resourceful.
Resourceful. We've gone from poop brooms to soup cans. We have evolved. So, obviously everybody's taken aback by these crude ass women, right?
Well, I mean, yeah. That's fair.
It's 1913. Can you imagine how that looked like?
I mean, I feel like we'd be pretty taken aback by a band of women with giant poop paintbrushes led by a very, very tall woman with a 10-foot flag.
It's fucking so cool.
I think that translates through the ages.
I wish they'd make a movie about her. I don't think the world's ready. I don't think the world is ready for Big Annie either. So as the National Guard moved in, Big Annie could not be intimidated. Obviously. One day a soldier on horseback, he pulled out his saber and he knocked the flag from her hands and like knocked her down, and like the horses are like stamping the flag and mud and stuff. It's super mean because this flag, like, don't fuck with her flag. You know what
I
mean?
No.
So she takes her flag and she wraps it around her body and she says, quote, "Run your bayonets and sabers through this flag and kill me. But I won't move. If this flag will not protect me, then I will die with it."
Well, shit.
She's badass.
Yeah.
Badass.
I mean, unfortunately, it won't protect you, so.
It won't protect you, but I like it. I like it.
Yeah. I like the spunk.
It's a real good quote. So, my management, still not fucking budging with the strike. They also create an organization because, I mean, it's not fair. I want one too. The Citizens Alliance. So 8,000 people join the Citizens Alliance while rocking their Citizen Alliance pins. Members would urge people to sign petitions denouncing the Western Federation of Miners, and they pledged to drive the union out of Copper Country for good. And they would even give you your own pin to wear.
Ooh.
You know. So if they saw you, they knew where you stood.
They did.
Mm-hmm. Sounds calm enough, right?
I mean, it sounds like a powder keg.
Yeah. Here's the truth of it. Citizen Alliance rallies were fully funded by mine management. And there was no shortage of entertainment and booze at these things.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now you have these people juiced up on alcohol and whatever propaganda they were being fed at these rallies. And when they were over, they wouldn't just go home and go to bed. No. They would go trash a union's headquarters or anything and everything associated with it. It's ridiculous. So Calumet and Hecla was basically doing anything and everything to make things miserable for the strikers. They had an abundance of already mined copper, and now they have a slew of replacement workers. So they actually welcome the dragging of the strike for, like, the foreseeable future. They're just like, whatever. We're not losing money. The strikers were, though. The mining company wanted them real nice and hungry, like, practically begging for their jobs back. And, you know, it's so gross. And that will teach them not to even entertain this union bullshit ever again. You know, don't do it. They really
this is some President Snow Hunger Games shit for sure.
It's so bad. I like cannot believe that I have never heard of this. The mine companies, they wanted to punish the strikers. Like, we're going to ignore you, but we also want to make you miserable, you know? Mm-hmm. And because they hired spies, they really had the inside scoop on how the union and strikers were like handling things. Intel from the mines was shared by coded letters.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. It's honestly like these managers, they're living out some stupid childhood fantasy. It's like,
yeah,
it's like, let's make our own language. I'll send you a code. It's just, all right.
I sound like children.
I actually found one of them. Can I
found one of them?
One of the letters. Can I read it please. To you?
Mm-hmm.
It's a little long. It's not terribly long, but bear with me because I found it very interesting. So this is one of the letters that Little Jim wrote. Okay. Everything quiet here today. Snowy, rosetting, arson, south radius, and arson misdirect, imperious harpy of strikers. There is no destruction of property. Mahoney, Canthus, Privy, Water Lily, Federation astounded, and has taken Chinchilla, imperial file. Subjugation leaders, heavy afooted, privately gruff, misapplication, was malignancy, imperious, using vertical, thereby giving us chest topple, comparison, spy, treachery. There is a dog among exploration, oblivious of unscrew. Marion Metropolitan of Executive Coil Unscrew, in invite tonight, says we cake spurt, misdirect pustules. This will probably lenity topple complimentary blanket strikers and treachery. I am arcade.
I feel like I'm having a stroke right now.
Mm-hmm. I am arcade topple gate pustules, enchant them, spurted, soon as possible, but woman nutmeg, unacceptable, it unload ample treachery, astound, and magically can be fully prolongation. Do not think it wise to topple disrobe arch thing, tome spurting, and upload strikers.
Stop saying
heavy
spurting.
Chest topple countenance off. Navy quote Glottis as saying spy treachery would be uppish topple prolongation magicals who wave topple wrestle. Territory, oh there is no more chest flirt resetting except blanket strikers and treachery. Absolutely no cause for worry. End letter.
Okay. First of all, with all that treachery and spurting, there's definitely cause for worry.
And pustules?
And pustules. There's a lot of that.
What's a woman nutmeg?
My brain feels like a scrambled egg after listening to that.
Ridiculous. I don't know. I couldn't get over how like incredibly sexual it was.
Yes.
Didn't it sound like a bunch of like
12-year-old boys in a treehouse?
Yes. Thank you. So this whole letter is basically saying that the union is sort of falling apart in their efforts. The part where he says there is a dog among exploration oblivious of unscrew, the translation to that is there is dissension among executive officers of the union.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for letting me do that.
Yeah.
So my management, they're just going to keep on letting it drag on. They're just hoping it's going to implode on itself. So come December, Little Jim has had about enough of this union shit. Like, he's trying to ignore it, but it's like, come on, guys, just give up already. He's ready just to tell these miners to pack their shit and find work elsewhere. Like, he doesn't want it looming. And he wasn't going to budge, obviously. And the whole thing is like a thorn in his side, you know?
Yeah.
So, because Little Jim is a stand-up guy, he is not just going to kick out a bunch of people out of their homes right before Christmas. He's not a monster.
I'm pretty sure he is.
Yeah, he totally is. He totally wanted to do that. Somebody more sympathetic convinced him to wait until after the holidays. So
I guess that's something.
I'm surprised anybody convinced him to do anything because it sounds like he just does whatever the fuck he wants.
Mm-hmm.
So while mine managers receive Christmas bonuses for their opposition to the strike, workers and their families, they were hardly scraping by. They were growing very wary of a strike that felt never ending. Big Annie noticed that this was beginning to be particularly hard on the children, and she quickly had an idea. She would organize a Christmas party to lift their spirits.
Oh, God.
She gathered donations from merchants and locals in hopes that every child could at least receive one.
Do these motherfuckers blow up the kids' Christmas party?
They don't blow it up. Just wait. So she's getting all these donations. She just, like, she's hoping, like, I hope I can give this kid an orange. Like, at least that. Something. You know, can you imagine, like, that's what you're trying to get these poor kids, you know? And it's not that none of this is their fucking fault. None of it.
Yeah.
None of it. And Big Annie, she wants to make these kids, like, something. Just to forget about this shit for a little bit.
Yeah.
Women worked tirelessly making new scarves and mittens for the children. The party was set to be held at the Italian Hall. The Italian Hall was a two-story building built in 1908, just 5 years earlier. And I, like, stumbled on this when I was kind of looking at the history of the building. It had been rebuilt. I guess it had burned down before, and they completely rebuilt the building. But I found, like, a really, like, super eerie detail was the dedication speech for this building was actually written by Little Jim. So with what's about to happen, like, it just, the whole thing just weirds me out. I don't know. The lower half of the Italian Hall, it had a grocery store and a bar, and the upper floor was a meeting hall, ballroom, and it had this, like, large stage. It was really big, could fit a lot of people for entertaining. To get to the second floor, you would actually enter from the outside. There was like this brick, this really pretty brick archway, and you just went through these double doors, and you would climb this 14-foot steep stairway to get up. So on Christmas Eve, between 500 and 600 children and 175 parents and chaperones arrived to the Italian Hall for the strikers' family Christmas party. And when I say chaperones, like, sometimes the neighbors took the kids. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. I've gotten into such a sense of false sense of complacency during this story. Just thinking about, like, labor studies classes I took in college and strikes and evil corporations. And I forgot that this is a disaster that affects a bunch of children.
Yep. It's
okay. And now suddenly I don't like where this is going.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Here we go. So Big Annie, she was super successful in her donation efforts, and the children, they would walk across the stage to meet Santa and receive an orange along with, like, a little sack of candy. So that, I thought that was super neat. Like, they got candy too.
Yeah, that's very sweet.
As the children were getting their treats, someone at the bottom of the stairwell opened the doors and screamed fire.
Fuck.
Twice. So Big Annie, she didn't see or smell fire, and she just kind of urged everyone to stay calm, carry on with the party, like, it's, don't worry, you know? But the damage had already been done. Panic ensued, and the word fire was being translated and screamed throughout the entire ballroom. You know, remember, like, there's so many different groups of people in here. So they're literally translating and screaming fire. One lady desperately tried to calm the frightened crowd. In a last-ditch effort, she got on stage and started playing the piano. Hoping,
oh,
like,
my God.
Just hoping that the crowd would realize that, like, oh, this lady's playing the piano. This has got to be a false alarm. You know what I mean?
Oh, there's always such a spooky freaking detail in stories like this.
Yes, right? It was too late. A massive stampede ensued, and everyone rushed the stairs. Now, what happens next is widely disputed and still a bit of a mystery. Some say that the man who yelled fire, possibly with some help, was holding the doors at the bottom of the stairs closed. Another theory is that someone fell, blocking the doors from the inside. The biggest debate on this is that the doors at the bottom of the stairwell open inward, and that the crowd at the bottom of the stairwell was, or stairwell was prevented from the, like, they couldn't get the doors open because of the crowd.
Yeah.
So people that support this theory, I'm there, hardcore, absolutely adamant, like, this was the case. The doors opened the wrong way. Even though there are literally photographs showing that the doors did open outwards, not inwards.
Hmm.
I don't know if it's a Mandela effect. So, I don't know. I've seen this a lot, and I personally think with this, it's just easier to blame an inanimate object, you know, instead of, like,
malevolence.
Realizing that somebody is capable of doing something so horrible. Yeah. It's easier to be like, it was because of the door, instead of being like, somebody just killed some people.
Yeah.
You know? Regardless of what happened, a crowd rushed the stairs and they fell on top of one another like dominoes in the 8-foot-wide, 14-foot-high stairwell. When the firefighters arrived, the stack of bodies was so high at the bottom of the staircase, like, it proved impossible to remove anyone. Although poorly marked, there was a fire escape on the side of the building. Entering the building this way, the firefighters painstakingly removed one body at a time from the stairwell, and the victims were taken to the nearby Calumet Theater. In the PBS one of the PBS documentaries I watched, there was actually a survivor on there who was a small boy when it happened. And he was talking about how he had remembered that he had lost his candy sack in the commotion. And so because he lost his candy, he was like crying out for his grandmother, only to be told that his grandmother was sleeping.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. It was really sad. Although not... There was never, like, official total. I couldn't really find out where the discrepancies were. But they say it was about 73 people that died in this stairwell.
And there never was any kind of fire.
There was no fucking fire. No fire. 73 people died, 59 of them children.
Mm.
And although this was the Italian Hall disaster, most of these victims were actually Finnish. They were also, like, bottom of the totem pole when it came to, like, desired workers.
Why?
So they're already treated like shit. It's just the way they fucking had it. It was, like, Finnish and Italian.
Hmm.
You know, and then you have, like, the German and stuff. That's, like... were held up higher, you know. Yeah. They tended to get, like, the better jobs and stuff, but yeah. So the night of the disaster, Charles, he rushes back to his hotel room. He immediately starts sending out telegrams to anyone and everyone that would listen, including President Woodrow Wilson. Fun fact, President Wilson actually put in more effort than any other earlier government to help workers. Wow. The United States Department of Labor really took shape during his two terms. And that's all the good stuff that we love here on Mark Safe. The occupational safety, workers' comp, all that stuff. Yeah. He sent in telegrams to everyone, to the president. And he's pissed.
Well, yeah.
Which, I mean, rightfully so. You know, he organized these people to do strikes. And it's feeling a lot like a mass murder right now. So, news of Charles sending these telegrams out quickly spreads, okay? And it's not long until, knock, knock, here comes old Sheriff Cruz and some local dignitaries, if you can call them that, to kindly ask him to stop sending these telegraphs. Mm. They also kindly asked Charles to issue a statement asking to exonerate the Citizens Alliance of any liability of the Italian Hall disaster.
I don't think so.
Huh? A what? Which is really strange because that shit literally just happened. And there hasn't been an investigation yet, you big dum-dum. Like, what are you talking about?
Interesting.
So Charles is like, fuck no, bro. So Sheriff Cruz says... Well, I can't protect you anymore then. Like, he said that to him. That's a quote. And then they leave. Well, just mere minutes later, knock, knock again on Charles' hotel door. In barges a group of 25 men. Any guesses on what accessory they're wearing?
Guns.
and Citizen Alliance pins.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. So they start beating the ever-loving shit out of Charles. Then one numb nuts hits Charles in the head with his pistol and the fucking gun goes off. The bullet gets lodged in Charles' back. Well, then this angry mob, they drag Charles to the Houghton Hancock Bridge, threatening to throw him in the river if he does not do what they ask. Jesus. Charles is still like, fuck no. So at this point, they're getting absolutely nowhere with Charles. And I guess as to not have another murder on their hands, they drag him to the depot and they throw him on a train to Chicago.
Shit.
How badass is Charles? Yeah. He's like, nope, 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 ain't doing it. So, yeah, they throw him on this train. I'm like, God, how long is that trip? You know, like you're with a bullet, like you just been shot. And can you imagine being a passenger on this train, like minding your own business, and then like here comes this guy, he's just shot. So once they reach Chicago, he's immediately rushed to the hospital for emergency surgery. And after the surgery, he asked for union officials to telegram federal officials. It read simply, the situation in Copper Country is out of control. So there were many witnesses stating that the man that yelled fire in the Italian Hall, I mean, he was wearing a Citizen Alliance pin.
Of course he was.
Like, hello, can you describe this man? I mean, that's like, they really didn't think this through. You're going to do some shit like that. Yeah, I don't know. So they have all these witnesses. Who are you going to tell? Sheriff Cruz? That guy? You going to tell him? Don't fret, though, because there were actually arrests made.
Really? I'm surprised.
Yeah, it did. So the next morning on Christmas, the local Finnish newspaper that was very pro-worker ran a headline that translated to 83 murdered.
Oh.
In response, our hero, Sheriff Cruz, rounded up those pesky newspaper editors and the bookkeeper and arrested them all.
Uh-oh.
He did. How dare they? These would actually be the only arrests made in this disaster.
Are you kidding me? You got my hopes up. Nope.
Still reeling from the disaster, funeral preparations were still needed to be made. Mine management publicly said they would give money to the victims' families if anybody needed it for burying their loved ones. I think this is like just one of those things where it's like when children are involved, even like the hardest person fucking bends, you know? It's a tragedy all the way around. So they did offer. They actually sent men door to door offering, you know, this money to help. Not a single person accepted the offer. Union leaders echoing that, quote, it's not charity we want, it's justice.
Ooh, shit.
The funeral was held December 28, 1913. Because of large-scale death, there wasn't enough hearses to transport the dead.
Oh, my God.
So the men carried caskets through the streets. These black and white photos, I'll have to post them. They're super heartbreaking, but as far as like historic photos, this is going to come off wrong, but they're quite beautiful.
Yeah.
It's just like this stark contrast that like all the men, they're like in their, you know, winter coats and stuff, but they're wearing all black and they're carrying these like bright white caskets and there's like the white snow. And I just, as far as historical photos, I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like it. Like it just speaks so much, like their faces, and I don't know, I'll post them. So the investigation, shoddy at best, because and only because someone died in a violent manner, an inquest was mandatory. The inquest took 3 days to complete. During the investigation, witnesses who didn't speak English were brought in to testify. They were asked and also forced to answer those questions in English only. Other witnesses were brought in who, they didn't even attend the party at Italian Hall. The coroner also had no medical experience, but he was friends with the sheriff, so that's okay.
That's perfect.
In the end, the cause of the death were simply left blank. So things clearly were out of control at this point. The United States Congress did try to step in and mediate the situation between the union and mine management company, but Little Jim still refused. Again, if we're handing out superlatives, Little Jim would get most stubborn. So when pressed why he just wouldn't come to some sort of compromise, Little Jim pulled out his wallet and held it up in the air and he said, quote, "This is my pocketbook. I won't arbitrate with you as to whose pocketbook this is. It would be foolish to arbitrate that question."
Oh, fuck off.
So in other words, yeah, I'm a greedy
fuck. This guy is officially worse than Scatino.
He is, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That guy was just a cowardly sack of shit. This guy's an evil sack of shit.
He makes me mad. In the end, the union funds were depleted and WFM folded. The mine management company's strategy to let the strike drag on worked. Only half the men were given their jobs back, but only by ripping up their cards and publicly denouncing the union. Wow. To pour salt on their wounds, the 8,000 men that were given their jobs back signed their names in a ledger and were made to each contribute an additional 5 cents from their paychecks for the purchase of an engraved pocket watch. Both were presented to Little Jim for breaking the strike.
Are you kidding me?
The inscription read, quote, "Due to your attitude of no compromise, the Copper Country is not afflicted with the presence of the Western Federation of Miners."
Wow.
So the strikers, they paid for that. They paid for that watcher. And I'm willing to wager that Little Jim totally got his rocks off on that.
Yeah, not to...
Because he is fucking
not
gross.
Not to make this comparison too many times, but that has very Mexico's gonna pay for the wall energy.
I told you, it's definitely, yes. He's disgusting. Yes. So, with the recent introduction of the Ford Model T, lots of the miners actually traveled south to finally work above ground in the Detroit factory, which obviously provided safer work environment as well as $2 more an hour. Copper Country mining died a slow death, but eventually the last one was shut down in 1960s. In 1941, folk singer-songwriter Woody Guthrie, who is widely known for the song "This Land Is Your Land," have you heard of him? He released a ballad about the Italian Hall disaster. The song was appropriately titled 1913 Massacre. It's a really beautiful song. I'll make sure we post it on our social media. I've had it on a repeat. I really like it. Woody took some artistic liberties in his ballad, but it accomplished what he had intended it to do. It would bring the story of the Italian Hall disaster back to the forefront, along with the American social injustices that came with it. Woody Guthrie and his song would also heavily inspire a budding young musician. On his debut album in 1962, Bob Dylan's song "To Woody" would use the music of Woody's 1930 massacre to pay homage to his greatest influence. Because of her own fight for social injustice, Big Annie was inducted to the Laborers International Hall of Fame and Michigan Women's Hall of Fame. Finally, in 1984, for reasons unknown, the Italian Hall was demolished. It's funny because I actually watched videos of this and it's almost as if the building itself wasn't going to go down without a fight. Like the wrecking ball was literally like just bouncing off exterior. Eventually, though, it did make headway and it was torn down. Some of the locals were very upset the Italian Hall was torn down, saying that the town of Calumet had plenty of other buildings in far worse shape with far less significance. Not all was lost, though. The brick archway from the entrance, where the stairway led up, that was saved. And in 1989, a park was dedicated to the victims of the Italian Hall disaster. It's really beautiful. It's in a park. It's just the archway standing alone, and there's a little bench that you can sit there if you want. If you wish to see the park and the archway, which is totally on my bucket list now, it's on 7th Street in Calumet, and that is the 1913 massacre.
Oh my God, that's horrible. I mean, you did a great job, but that's horrible.
It's sad, huh?
Yeah, and I feel like this was advertised as being less dark than the last episode.
I'm sorry about that, too.
I'm not following on that one.
Lil Jim is probably the worst evil villain. Yeah. I can't. It's so
weird.
He's like
a cartoon villain. He's ridiculous.
It's so weird that, like, these people, like, are real and they exist. And it's really fucking scary.
Yeah, it is.
And it still goes on today, you know? This is not some, like, isolated early 1900s thing. Like, it's just weird. It's like recycled grossness.
It never ends.
It never ends. So, but my next episode is going to be about poop.
I mean, there was poop in this one too.
Oh, there was. Maybe this is my thing. I like poop.
Oh, God.
I'm really excited about my next episode.
I'm really excited about mine.
I'm really excited about yours.
And then I'm going to end up not actually doing that one. We'll see.
No, don't do that. Just do it.
All right. I want to do it justice.
All right. I have to, I was going to say I have to go to bed. I don't have to go to bed.
You don't?
It's early.
Yeah, that's true.
I got to help Cody pack. And then I'm going to go to bed. So I better jump off of here.
All right. Well, thank you for that terrible tale.
All right. Sweet dreams or no dreams.
Sweet dreams or no dreams.
Hey, Horrible Ghouls. Hope you enjoyed this week's episode. If you would like to share your personal MarkSafe moment, you can send it to us at MarkSafePodcast@gmail.com. Please give our podcast a rate, review, and subscribe, and tell your buddies about us too. That goes a long way. If you want to further elevate your support, check out our MarkSafe Patreon page, where we have shoutouts, goodies, and some bonus content in the works. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Thanks again, and as always, stay safe.